This holiday, switch to Cricket Wireless and get a free 4G LTE smartphone with no annual contract. Cricket Wireless, something to smile about.
Requires number 40 and service activation. Minimum $30 per month. Applies to ZTE Overture 3. First month service charge and in-store activation fee up to $25 due at sale. Tax restrictions apply. One-time fees may apply. See store for details.
When you don't go to Geico.com, car insurance can be hard. Like early 90s heavy metal hard.
I'm yelling and screaming and I'm loud. Roar.
Geico makes it easy. You can review and update your policy or report a claim on Geico.com or the Geico mobile app. Because shouldn't we all have a little less stress in our lives?
I'm not even upset about anything.
Blog Talk Radio.
Je vous écoute. Je vous écoute.
Live, several miles from Hollywood. It's Advice Goddess Radio. With nationally syndicated advice columnist Amy Alcorn. Q-Tip News. You call from? Should call from that? Shouldn't call from the end of that?
Hello, welcome. This is nationally syndicated advice columnist Amy Alcorn with Advice Goddess Radio. Nerd your way to a better life with the best brains in science. Now, for a long time, we've taken a sort of Clint Eastwood lone gunman view of what it takes to have a good relationship, that we should need nobody and nothing but what we can provide for ourselves. Depending on somebody else is supposed to be a weakness, and it's supposed to be a sign that we need to go back to self-esteem summer school. Well, neuroscientist Dr. Amir Levine and psychologist Rachel S.F. Heller say that attachment theory applied to adults has come to show that this thinking is wrong. Levine and Heller are authors of the book Attached, The New Science of Adult Attachment and How It Can Help You Find and Keep Love. And Dr. Levine, one of the pioneers in adult attachment, is with us tonight. So stick with us as he explains why our need for a secure bond with our partner is actually essential, what kind of person we should look to form one with, and how we can do that. Hello, Amir.
Hi.
Hi. So attachment theory comes out of work with babies originally by British psychiatrist John Bowlby. So tell us a little bit about who he was and what he found out.
Right. So John Bowlby was a psychoanalyst, and he actually made this like amazing leap where he basically said, you know, Before he came around, people used to think babies attach to their parents because to their mothers because she's giving them water and sustenance, and that's what they attach. But Bowlby said, no, we attach because we attach. It's a primary need that we have. And even children who were giving food and water and shelter, if they did not have that one person to attach to, they would fail to thrive. And that's what he observed. So attachment really is a basic need, just as food and water.
Right. It's a secure emotional bond with a figure like the mother. And actually, what was very interesting that I read in your book, Attached, was that Bowlby had always claimed that attachment is an integral part of human behavior throughout the entire lifespan, not just for babies.
Right. It's basically a system that stays in our brain for our whole lifetime. And you can see, I remember like when I was working in the hospital and I would see even people who were very old, people who were dying, would call out for their mothers or for their loved ones. I mean, because we get attached throughout our lifetime. Just like we need to eat all of our life, that's also, we have that need for attachment throughout our whole lifespan.
And now the attachment system, this is the system, the mechanism in our brain that's responsible for tracking and monitoring the safety and the availability of these attachment figures like our mother or a relationship partner. And this system there are three styles you write about in it: anxious, avoidant, and secure. And maybe you can just define, let's go through each one of them. What is a person who is anxiously attached?
Right. So basically it's a system in our brain that it's all about safety and how we feel safe. So a person who is an anxious attachment style, they they love to be intimate and close, and it's very important to them, but they have a very sensitive radar system. So they're very sensitive to small cues that may suggest that their partner is not available to them. So that's the person who has an anxious attachment style.
And so the avoidant attachment style, that person, they're sort of a distance-seeking person in the relationship.
So exactly. The avoidant person who has an avoidant attachment style, they also want to be in a relationship because we just said, what Baldy said, that we all want, like, it's all important for us to choose someone out from the crowd and make them unique and special to us. But something funny happens when they get close, they start to feel uncomfortable with too much intimacy. And so they find ways, they have these different ways of keeping their partners at arm's length. So that's the avoidant attachment style.
And then
the security.
Oh, yeah, go ahead with the secure one.
Yeah, secure is easy. Someone, and that's it's people who also love to be close and intimate. You never can get too close or too intimate to them. But they don't have that sensitive radar system. They don't really tend to worry a lot about not being loved back. They're just very warm and loving.
So now let's talk about where our attachment styles come from. You know, it's been thought that these are determined by how you were cared for by a baby, but it seems they're actually influenced by a variety of factors.
Right. So that's what I think is really great. And that's part of the reason me and my co-author, Rachel Heller, really wanted to write this book. It's because a lot of the time people really think, oh, it's a very fixed. The way that we were treated as young children really determines how we were going to treat our loved ones. But apparently it turns out that it's not exactly like that. We're much more versatile. As human beings, we're very highly, highly social species. We're very adaptable. And we actually can, our attachment style can change. And it can change throughout our whole lifespan. And we found that to be very, very promising. And that's one of the reasons we wanted to write this book, because people can change their attachment style, which can actually make them happier in their relationships.
Yeah, this is one of the things I love about your book, and I should do a little station ID for people who just tuned in. I'm talking with Dr. Amir Levine, neuroscientist, co-author with psychologist Rachel S.F. Heller of this excellent book, Attached, The New Science of Adult Attachment and How It Can Help You Find and Keep Love. Because this isn't just, okay, you're stuck, you had a mean, cold mother, and now you're going to have problems for the rest of your life. You show in the book how someone who has an anxious attachment style can be with someone who's secure, and they can sort of reparent them and love them and make them feel more secure.
Right. You know, it's actually, it reminds me something that someone told me, someone that I know told me about her parents. She said that actually they were married since, they were basically high school sweethearts, and they were married for many, many years. And then her mother, at some point, she told her, you know, when we met, I didn't really like myself so much. I didn't really feel so good about myself. But they were so much in love. Like every Tuesday for decades, he would send her a little card, love, like with flowers. And then she said, well, you know, after a while, when you're being told how much you're beautiful and how much you're lovable, you start to believe the other person. And that's basically kind of like the idea.
Yeah, and people don't really understand how important it is to do these little tender, loving things. I just wrote a column on this, you know, and just to even, you know, my boyfriend does this for me. He hates when I mention things he does on the radio show. Sorry, Greg. But he sends me these little 20-second videos that he shoots on his phone that make me laugh. You know, and those little, being noticed, being remembered, you know, that somebody wants to make you laugh, that makes you feel loved.
Right. It's basically, again, it's basically the whole attachment system. As I said before, it's a system that arouses to allow us to feel safe. And as human beings, yeah, it's important for us to have a roof over our head. It's important for us to have money in the bank. But the primary way for us to feel safe is through other people, is through our relationship with other people. And
now,
if they don't make us feel safe, then we're in trouble.
I'm going to get into this fascinating stuff that you write about how dependency actually isn't a bad word, but I wanted to first talk about, you know, evolution, and that you write that each attachment style, whether you're anxious or avoidant and distance-seeking or secure, that these all most likely evolved in order to increase the survival chances of humans in a particular environment. You know, and so you say that the secure attachment style worked for humans best because of our close-knit groups that we lived in, but sometimes that wasn't always optimum.
Right. So that's what also another, there's a lot of things that we really made us want to write this book. But one of the reasons is that attachment science is not based in psychopathology. It's really based in developmental psychology, which means that we're not dealing with any, it's not being healthy or being sick. It's all natural variations on a certain theme of getting attached. So it's just the same way that we have tall people and short people. We also have different people with different attachment styles. And sometimes it really works to have someone who's completely super hyper vigilant about the whereabouts of other people or their close partner, because it makes them, in times when there's a lot of danger, it makes it possible for them to save the other person. So it can work actually in your favor if you're super, super hyper vigilant. And sometimes it also works to be distant.
Right, and you say that in hostile conditions in the evolutionary environment, that skills other than collaborative ones like this vigilance, that these were very important. So I think it's a very important thing you say, that it's not pathology. In other words, it's not disease. You aren't mentally ill. This is just something that worked for us in the evolutionary environment, and that sometimes is a mismatch when somebody isn't doing something suspicious and you're acting like they are.
Right, so the problem is that evolution is not about the happiness of the individual. It's more about the survival of the species, right? So the evolution would actually compromise your happiness in order for you to survive. So the fact that you have a certain attachment style that would actually prove itself to be very, very good if there's like a terrible famine around and everybody like dropped around you, but you can continue to go on because you were distant, doesn't mean that that's going to help you in your everyday life, like currently in the world that we live in today. So evolution doesn't care about that. But we do.
Yes, we do. And actually, one thing that makes people very miserable is this idea that they should be emotionally self-sufficient, and that intimacy, wanting intimacy and closeness, this is a sign you're a loser, you know, there's something wrong with you. And you actually say that getting attached means that our brain gets wired to seek the support of our partner. And, you know, that we want to ensure their proximity and want them to reassure us. And we're programmed to continue trying for that until they do.
Right. So basically, there's all these studies that show. So people have this idea that it's bad to be dependent on someone else. But, you know, guess what? It's just our biology. When we choose someone else from the crowd and make them special and unique to us, we become dependent on them, not just psychologically, but also physiologically. Because they start to control things that we have no control over, like our autonomic nervous system. They do influence how we breathe, how we sleep, our blood pressure. And there's some studies that show that if you're in a good relationship and you suffer from high blood pressure, it will actually keep it at bay. But if you're in a bad relationship, it's going to get much worse. And there's another even, that the most amazing study, that I'd really like to often mention. They show that if you get a cut and you're in a good relationship, it will heal faster than if you're not in a good relationship. So it's not just so basically we become one physiological unit with our partner when we become attached. So this whole idea of dependency, whether it's good or bad, it's just a biological fact. We have to live with it.
It's really, that cut thing is pretty incredible. And I wanted to mention also that you talk about the dependency paradox, that, you know, that when people's needs are met, you know, then they can actually become more independent.
Right. And I think the way to understand that, and as we've talked a little bit about that before the show, I think the best way to understand this dependency paradox is if we understand how attachment styles were first discovered, because we're talking about the anxious, avoidant, and secure. And these were styles that were first discovered by a woman whose name is Mary Ainsworth. And she did this experiment that's called the strange situation test. And maybe I should tell you a little bit about that.
Oh, yeah, no, do tell us. That's really important to talk about.
So the strange situation test, you can actually see it on YouTube. It's really amazing. She got a mother and a one-year-old to come into the lab, which is like a room full of toys. And there's a one-way mirror through which you watch the kids and the mother. And typically what would happen is that the child would see all these toys, will start crawling around and play with all the toys. And then they ask the mother to step out for a moment, and the person and the child just stayed with the research assistant. So immediately you can see it. The child drops everything and starts running, crawling to the door, starts banging on the door and crying. And the research assistant tries to give her a toy. So just throw it in her face. And then they ask the mother to come back. And it's their reunion that where she actually identified these attachment styles. Because the people who were the children who were secure, when the mother picked them up, they come down very quickly and start playing with the toys again. The anxious ones were not exactly like that. They would come maybe for a moment, but then start crying again, or they would have a very hard time using the mother, utilizing her in order to calm down. And the avoidant ones were just like basically almost like ignore the mother, or just like would stay limp in their hands. But also they wouldn't resume the play. So both the anxious and the avoidant had a hard time using the other person, their mother, to basically calm themselves down. And the difference is how quickly did they start playing with the toys again. So now as adults, we don't play with toys anymore, but we have the same system, as we said, and that's another thing that Bowlby said. And so basically, if we become dependent on someone, we can tend to our jobs better, tend to our hobbies better, be better parents. We have more of that exploratory drive that you see in children and the toys in the strange situation test.
And so, and then how does this play out with Brooke Feeney? Actually, she tested this in adult relationships and found that when couples' goals are supported by their partner, that they actually report an increase in self-esteem and their mood went up after they talked about their goals. They were more likely to achieve them. So this really does, it is really supported by research that that secure attachment, secure base in an adult relationship really makes a huge difference.
Right, exactly. So as you mentioned, it's really, it becomes really, really crucial to have that secure base. It really changes our whole lives because when we know that we have someone to rely on, or God forbid something, we go out into the world and something bad happens to us, that we can always go back to someone who's going to soothe us and take care of us, it gives us a very, very strong base. And then all the, like that's the dependency paradox, basically, because when we know that, we don't even usually people, even anxious people, don't tend to go back and are not as sensitive or and not as needy as you would think, because they're much more interested in the environment and doing things outside of their relationship. They tend to face outworld into the world.
And so that secure relationship, that's the loving relationship where the person isn't ducking closeness. They're there for you. They're supportive. And so, and that is what, that's what gives you a secure base.
Yeah, I think it's mostly the, you know, one of the things that we did with the book is basically we spent the last half portion in attached. We've interviewed all these secure people trying to understand some of their secrets and what makes them so secure. And so we found some of their methods of how they provide you with that secure base. And there's some different examples.
I love that because you make this very practical. We're going to get into the attachment styles and the solutions which you provide, which is great. I want to just do a little station ID. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the Best Brains in Science. My guest tonight is neuroscientist Dr. Amir Levine. He's co-author with psychologist Rachel S.F. Heller of the excellent book Attached, The New Science of Adult Attachment and How It Can Help You Find and Keep Love. Stick with us. Dr. Levine will explain how understanding attachment can help you stop your self-defeating dating behavior, make your relationship happier and more secure, and that's whether your person's seeking more closeness or more distance. So I want to first talk about the anxious attachment style, and just to go back to that, this is the person who needs intimacy but worries the partner doesn't want to be as close and is chasing after it. And so this anxious attachment style, you say that these people have what you call a chronically activated attachment system. Can you talk about what that is?
So the attachment system, again, it's the system in our brain that really, it's a way for us to feel safe. So we feel safe when we know, and that's actually, it just, we are basically the descendants. We talked about evolution also. There was a huge advantage in evolution to choose someone else out from the crowd and make them special and unique to us. And those who paired up survived, and those who didn't ended up more often than not as tiger food. So we're basically the offsprings of those who paired up. But the pairing up wasn't so much so like, okay, I can take it or leave it. If you're here, it's fine. If you're not here, that's okay too. No, it was more like, I really need you to be by my side. And if you're not by my side, I need to know where you are. Because if I don't know that, I'm going to feel very uncomfortable until I reestablish contact with you. So that's the attachment system. And I can tell you that if I were to tell you now that, God forbid, where you your loved ones are, if there was a horrible disaster or something like that, it would be very hard for you to keep on listening and talking to me. You'd have to sort of like either run and make a phone call just to make sure that they're okay. And that's basically our attachment system at work. And it's all the time at work. It's sort of like a surveillance system. And you kind of have an idea where your loved ones are and that they're okay. But if you think that they're not, you're going to be very, very unsettled until you reestablish contact with them.
And so the anxiously attached person who needs intimacy and worries that the person's sort of running off from them, you write that they feel like their life is in the danger zone, you know, like their relationship is always threatened. And so they're operating from that point. And so that's a very stressful way to have a relationship.
So, yes, but you see, the thing is, when we talk about attachment, we're always talking about a dyad. So I can give you an example.
A dyad let me explain. A dyad meaning two. We've got two forces going on.
Right, exactly. So there's something that happens in the space between two people, basically. It's not just them on their own feeling very anxious, but it's something that evolves between the two people. So I'll give you an example. Suppose that your partner is going away on a business trip, and you tend to be anxious, and so they're going away, and it's raining, and you're worried that they're not getting to the airport on time, or the flight isn't going to take off, and you just... So what you do is that you text them on the phone that they're going on a business trip and they're like really busy and they're stressed out and they see you calling and they're like, oh, I don't have time to talk to this person now. And they hit ignore. So they hit ignore. That makes you even more anxious. So you're trying to call again. You're trying to text again. And they're like, oh, my God, this person, like, he's so needy or she's so needy. They just turn off the phone. So by the time they get to their destination, you're like fuming. They call you, let's say, at 2 a.m. at night and you get into a huge fight. But so that would be like someone anxious trying to sort of reestablish contact, but really having a hard time doing it. And then that makes them really, really unsettled. But suppose you were more someone who is more secure and you were like, oh, I know my partner gets really anxious when I'm leaving and it's raining. Let me just text them for a moment. Let them know that I'm okay. And they'll text you also just a way before the plane takes off. They'll text you when the plane lands. So by the time they get to their destination at 2 a.m. and they try to call you, you're already fast asleep. You're not so worried anymore. So just to give you, so yeah, you do have that very sensitive radar system, but if there's no reason to worry, if the other person actually gives them the security that they crave, then they're fine. They're not even going to feel that anxiety.
See, that's such an important thing to notice. And you talk about this thing you call protest behavior, where the person who is feeling distance, they're trying to over and over, you know, reestablish contact and that way that the secure person can just do these little kind things like text them, know they're anxious, that can stop that and really calm the person down so they don't get so activated, so they aren't chronically stressed. And that makes such a difference in the relationship.
Yeah, we like to call it sort of like basically to turn out a small flame before it becomes a forest fire. And that's what secure people are so good at. They're just really, really good at it. They know their partner's needs, and they know how to meet their needs. They're not like they're very, very in tune, and it makes life so much easier. It's much, much easier than when you have to 2 a.m. after you got to the hotel try to really calm the person down. But I love that you mentioned protest behavior. I think it's such a key thing to understand. And basically, it's the same thing as I mentioned the strange situation test. It's like having a child lost in the supermarket looking for, like, what they start doing is that they're really starting to, they start to cry in a terrible, terrible way, because that's a way for them to get, that's protest behavior. It's basically a way to reestablish contact with the person that you lost, because to us, it feels very, again, it was a huge advantage to know, to have the other, your partner, know where you are, because those who didn't oftentimes ended up as prey. It was a huge advantage to being in a unit, in a group, as compared to just being on your own. Being on your own, in our mind, in our attachment system, translates into danger.
And now you talk about how mismatched attachment styles can lead to a great deal of unhappiness in a relationship, but also in dating. And you say, this is so amazing, that anxiously attached people, so those are the people who need intimacy, need to be close, and are worried the partner's escaping, that those people often end up dating people with an avoidant attachment style, the people who are more distance-seeking. Why would they be attracted to somebody who wants to distance themselves?
Right. So that's one of the things that one of the reasons why my co-author and I, Rachel Heller, wanted to write this book is because we really think it really gives you a blueprint to dating. And we mentioned the three attachment styles, the anxious, the avoidant, and the secure. But it's two of them that where a lot of the relationship drama happens, and that's between the anxious and the avoidant. One loves intimacy and closeness. That's the anxious. The avoidant tries to minimize it. One is super sensitive to different cues that the other person is actually creating a distance. The other person tries to create distance all the time. For one, it's very important to get reassured all the time. The other person thinks, oh, each person should take care of themselves in a relationship. So they really have these opposite ideas about relationships, and they kind of like reinforce each other's belief. One believes, oh, these other persons are going to really try to get me, to really going to try to be very needy. The other thinks that, oh, we're not going to be loved as much. And they really reinforce each other's beliefs.
Well, I think also the fact that you point out that these are not pathological behaviors, but evolved behaviors that made sense in a certain kind of evolutionary environment, that this helps, and that people can look at these in your book, and I should do a little station ID, and see, okay, this is my propensity, and so here's what I can do. We're going to get into some of those solutions for the anxiously attached person dating. As soon as I do that, this is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the Best Brains in Science. My guest tonight is neuroscientist Dr. Amir Levine. He is co-author with psychologist Rachel S.F. Heller of the book Attached, The New Science of Adult Attachment, How It Can Help You Find and Keep Love. Stick with us, and I recommend the book. I think it's really terrific and really practical, which I always love. So I want to talk about the anxious person dating, the anxiously attached, again, needing intimacy, chasing after it. When they're dating, you say that there are a few things that they can do, and one of them is to acknowledge and accept their true relationship needs, that they need intimacy and security, and not to be embarrassed about it, and to look for people who can fulfill that.
Right. So the thing is, one of the things they say when you're going out to, when you're dating, I think the first thing you have to do is to learn how to tell what your attachment style is, and also learn how to identify other people's attachment style. And that's crucial, especially if you're anxious, because you have to find someone who has a secure attachment style. As I just gave you that example, there's a huge difference in your life if you're going to be with someone secure or if you're going to be with someone avoidant. With that little example of going to the airport, it's just, you can see how different it can be, your life can be, if you were someone secure. So basically,
I just wanted to say, though, but you say in the book that people like this who are anxious, they start to equate the anxiety and preoccupation and obsession, you know, that they go through in a relationship with love. So they become sort of programmed to get to go with people who make them unhappy.
Right. So what happens usually is that people, I think we're all basically trained to basically play hard to get in when we're dating, and not actually, especially if we're anxious, we're trained to sort of not tell people what our true needs are. So people who are anxious learn to not actually say no. It's really important for us to be very close and very intimate. We're looking for a relationship from pretty much early on. So if you play hard to get, usually what's going to happen is you're going to attract someone who's avoidant. And then without even knowing it, you've attracted someone that is not really going to be able to give you what you need. And then a few weeks later or a few months later, you say, well, no, actually, it is important for me that you'll call me. And it's important for me that you will be connected, and it's important for me that you'll show up and be reliable. But if you haven't done that before, if you haven't actually laid it out from the very get-go, you might end up attracting someone who's not going to be able to give you what you need.
Well, how do you express those needs without seeming needy, which is really unattractive to people also?
Right. So that's another thing that we always hear. I always like to tell the story about someone that we know, that Rachel and I know, who actually by the age of 40, she was dating a lot. She was in relationships, but she never got, she really wanted to get married and have kids. And she was just like, she felt that their time was running out. So she started going out with people. And from the very first date, she was like, you know, I'm looking to get married and I'm looking to have kids. And that's what I'm interested in, that I'm looking to do that as soon as possible. So sure enough, maybe if you sort of send a few people running the other direction, but pretty quickly she actually met someone who actually wanted the same thing. And so if you say it from a place of strength, it doesn't really have to come across as being needy. Oftentimes what comes across as being needy is if you actually don't say things from a place of strength and from a place of this is who I am, this is what I want. It's actually being authentic usually doesn't come across as being needy. It comes across very powerful.
Well, one of the things that I like that you say is that I think is helpful for people to be confident. You say to go by the abundance philosophy. You know, people always think, oh, my God, there's the one. I've got to find the one. But you know that there are a lot of potential partners out there. We've talked about this on past shows, that there isn't the one. And if you think about that and think, I can toss this one if he's not right or she's not right, then you're more likely to be able to identify people who are actually avoidant and distancing.
Right. I mean, one of the things that happen also is that especially if you're people, we've noticed that people who have an anxious attachment style get attached very quickly and oftentimes not to people who are necessarily good for them in terms of their other attachment style. So you go out with someone and you don't really know, and especially if you're not trained. And that's what we try to do in the book. We try to really teach you to listen to this new language, the language of attachment, and really be able to tell what attachment style the other person is and also know about yourself and know whether there's a mismatch from early on in the relationship. Because we find out that people really tell you, you just have to listen. They will tell you everything about themselves in terms of their attachment style.
And
so
I was going to say, the insights that you give, you know, I think are really important because it helps people to understand what their behavior is. And you say this about the anxiously attached person. I have a little note here. They'll begin to crave the other person's closeness, you know, and do anything to make a relationship work before they even get to know them or decide whether they like them or not. It's about closeness. It's not about the person. And if you can realize that, I think, and you're one of these people who's anxiously attached, who's always craving attachment and chasing the distancer, I think that that can help you avoid that propensity if you just recognize it.
Right, that's exactly it. Because oftentimes what happens, they go, like someone who's anxious, they'll go out with someone, and it's not about, is this person right for me or not? It's more like, oh, I've got to make them like me. You feel that if you'll do anything, even the smallest little thing, they're not going to like you anymore, and everything depends on this one person. And you kind of like lose sight of what you really need and and there are certain things that, especially someone who has an anxious attachment style, you have certain needs, and if they're not going to be met, you're not going to be happy in your relationship, and that's going to affect your whole life. Because as we saw, the dependency is so important.
I would suggest for this kind of person something that I just named date rationing, and it's something I recommend in my column, where if you're somebody who tends to just glom onto somebody right away, that you go out for these limited time dates, you go out for a happy hour, you have something afterward or pretend you have something afterward, and that way, you know, you don't get into this date marathon where you're prone to say, oh my God, this is the person for me, when it's just like, this is a person and, you know, I'll take anyone.
When it's too early to tell. And especially, yeah, because I think especially if you learn how to listen to attachment styles, you can tell pretty early. I think what happens, a lot of people have an anxious attachment style. The problem is also here. I'll tell you, that's one thing I almost forgot to tell you, is that we have in our society, we've had this problem that we start to associate, people associate avoidance with masculinity. Because people think, oh, men are closed off, men are avoidant, men don't express their emotions. But the truth is, like, the research actually shows us something very different. It shows us that most men and women are actually secure. And we didn't get a chance to talk about the statistics, but the good news is that more than half of the population, more than about 54% of the population are secure, and about 25% are avoidant, and the rest are anxious, and small percentage are both anxious and avoidant. So the majority of the population, both men and women, are secure. And there's a lot of men out there who can share their feelings and share their emotions and are not afraid of being close. And so I think a lot of women start to equate avoidance with masculinity, and they're looking for that. They think, oh, this guy is actually emotional and forthcoming and available. Oh, maybe there's something wrong with him. We need to look more. We need to look for someone else.
Yeah, you make this great point that people who are anxious, those who are craving intimacy and chasing the distant, that they actually need to remember to give secure people a chance. You know, that to remember that their attachment system gets activated, their danger signs get activated by the roller coaster, by the undependent person, and that, you know, those are the women, they tend to be women who complain that somebody's boring because he's dependable.
Right. So actually, it's both men and women, but we, like, somehow what happens is that they start to equate anxiety with love. So for them, if the person is not calling them or is not texting them, if they're not getting in touch with them, for them, there's like, oh, my God, my heart is missing a beat. I'm waiting for them. I'm losing my mind. That means that I'm attracted to them. But that means that I'm really interested. That means that I'm passionate about this person. But what it really means that they're anxious about what's going on, and the other person is like keeping them stranded. And that's a very bad sign.
Now, we have a question from our chat room. Let's see. Do you want someone that orbits around you so that you think they are their center of gravity, or do you want to orbit around each other? I think he's talking about a secure relationship there, and we'll get into that in a little bit. But I wanted to go on to avoidant style. And avoidant, again, is the person who wants a little more distant. And you say, actually, that they are just as vulnerable to threats of separation, but those feelings tend to be buried.
Right, it's almost like the same side of the two different sides of the same coin. So they also have this really sensitivity to, they have like this sensitive radar system, but instead of sort of like what the anxious person does is that they go into hyperdrive and they go into all this protest behavior. So the solution that the avoidant finds is that instead of doing that, they just bury everything, they repress everything, and they, for them, it's just important for them. They say, no, we have to be self-sufficient. But it's really a defensive strategy.
Yeah, and so now this type, you said they are really bad, the avoidantly attached people, so the distancing people, they're very bad at reading and translating their verbal and nonverbal signals they get from their partners. And so that means that they, you know, not only want to be distant, they have a hard time understanding that somebody is suffering.
Right, exactly. And I'll give you for example. I always like to give this example. I know someone. I mean, I'll call her Susan. And so she was planning this amazing trip to Paris, and she thought, we're going to have this romantic trip with her husband. We're going to have this romantic trip. We're going to walk hand in hand down the Seine, and we're going to have such a good time together. But when they got there, to her dismay, what she found out is that no matter that she actually wasn't able to do that, because all the time her husband was walking a few steps ahead of her constantly. And no matter how fast she was trying to walk, he would walk faster and faster. But the thing is, Susan actually knows him and knows his work, so she didn't really take it too seriously. So she said, okay, by the time we'll get to the cafe and we'll stop and we'll have coffee, we'll catch up. And she was fine with it. But the thing is, other people may be really upset because of that. It was like, oh my, I can't believe I came all the way to Paris, France, to just watch his butt in front of me the whole time. Because I think, so that's kind of like the people who are avoidant, they need their distance. And then going on a vacation like that, it's a huge opportunity for great intimacy and closeness. And they just can't handle that. It's too much for them. So he found little ways of sort of like separating them a little bit and minimizing the closeness and intimacy. Like, for example, walking in front of someone. But they have a lot of other tactics to minimize intimacy. So if you're secure, like Susan, you'll be able to deal with it. But if you're anxious, you're going to have a much, much harder time. And that's why we also talk a lot about this, the match and the mismatch between the different attachment styles. Because you can be avoidant, but also for you, it will be good to be with someone who is secure. Because think about, okay, if you get to the next cafe, you'll have a chance to catch up. But what if you're with someone anxious? You get to the next cafe, you get into a huge fight, which can destroy the whole vacation. So also for you, it's good to be with someone who is secure. It's going to make a huge difference in your life.
Yeah, and I love, you propose many solutions in your book, Attach, and I'm talking with Dr. Amira Levine, neuroscientist, co-author with Rachel S.F. Heller, psychologist of Attach, the new science of adult attachment and how it can help you find and keep love. And one of the things you write in the solutions section is, you know, it's kind of like the pragmatism of this woman you're describing, that you admit to yourself that in certain areas your mate is never going to be an active partner and stop making them change. And it helps if you understand where it's coming from. And so, for example, in my own life, my boyfriend is an introvert. I like to joke that his favorite kind of social event is one that's canceled. And so I try not to take him to parties because it makes him unhappy. You know, and if he's at a party, he's going to go find the dog, you know, or read a book.
Right.
Because introverts are upset by too much stimulation. And so if you accept the realities and you know it doesn't mean the person doesn't love you, it's just how their brain works, then it can be much less emotionally charged when they behave in certain ways.
Right, so that's key. That's exactly key. What you just said is that, like, when you really you understand, you sort of basically get into their head, and you understand that it's not about you, that it's not that they don't love you as much, or that they or anything, or that it's not that when they're going to stay home, they're going to maybe go on the internet and try to find someone else. You see, these are the things that people who are anxious are going to think. But once you really understand, no, it's not about you, that they love you and they just want to stay home, then it makes it much easier, much, much easier.
Yeah, and that's why it's so important to understand these different styles of attachment. Secure, which is the warm and loving person, the avoidant, the distance seeking, and the anxious person who needs intimacy is chasing after the distancer. And now we're talking now about avoidant people. Those are the distancers. And you give some solutions for how they can stop pushing love away. And one of them is to actually de-emphasize self-reliance and focus on mutual support, and talk about how you talk about in your book that, you know, that it's natural in a relationship to rely on each other. It's part of it.
Right. So part of the thing that people who are avoidant do is that they really, in a really defensive way, they really think both of us have to take care of our own needs. We have to rely only on ourselves. We can't rely on each other, because that would mean that we're not independent. And for them, they equate independence and self-reliance as something that that's how they feel. They just don't feel comfortable with being reliant on someone else. But if they start to understand what we talked about before, is that when you choose someone else from the crowd, it's just a biological fact. We become reliant on them. We can't even control it. We become like one physiological unit. Then they may actually give more room to, maybe I should let my partner do these things for me. It will help me. I don't have to protest. I don't have to actually step away. I can let them support me.
And now you say this other thing, that the avoidant person, the distancer, they tend to shortchange themselves in love, to push the person away that they're with by convincing themselves that they have this true longing for someone from their past, which you call a phantom ex, or they say that there's one perfect partner out there. So they use that to say, I don't have that person yet. But you say they have to actually understand that they're going to have a propensity for that and stop doing this.
Right. So, I mean, it's easier said than done. But I think what we mentioned before, the protest behavior that's so typical of someone who has an anxious attachment style, the calling, the checking, the sort of like fighting, the threatening to leave, all these things are basically things that are protest behavior. So there's someone who has an avoidant attachment style has something that's called the activating strategies. And that's kind of like the opposite of protest behavior. That's any action that minimizes intimacy and closeness in the relationship. So walking a few steps ahead of you, or staying at work until very late, or even small things like noticing, like all of a sudden being bothered by the way you sneeze or the way you eat, small things that kind of like, or making small comments, sort of derogatory comments about your partner. These are all the activating strategies. Their purpose is mainly to minimize intimacy and closeness. And the biggest ones are the one you described, are basically sort of thinking about a phantom ex, someone that basically oftentimes they broke up with that all of a sudden become bigger than life, or thinking about an idealized person that their partner never really will match up to. And that's always a way to sort of like bring in distance into the relationship. They're never really quite at ease with their partner.
But you say that for this person, the avoidant person, the distancer, you know, that if they can actually do the opposite of what their propensity is, which is they want to run away, but if they can just bring in little bits of closeness, like, person, I love you, do these tiny things, then the other person's not going to go psycho and chase after them. So they can actually change the tone of their relationship just with these little tiny nice things.
Right, so that's what we say. So these are like that. Now we're coming into the secure realm of like all the little things that people who are secure do naturally, that people who are avoidant and anxious can learn in order to make their lives much, much better. So what you just said about, we call that, as I told you before, we call that turning out small flames before they become forest fires. And that's really something that people who are, I think the thing is, what we found is that people who are secure, they live by a very simple axiom, and that is that we like to call it the happy wife, happy life philosophy. So they know it's really important. They know that if their partners are happy, that their partner's well-being is their well-being. It's not just a metaphor. If their partners are happy, they're going to be happy, and vice versa. If they're not going to be happy, they're going to be miserable too, because, again, we're one physiological unit. So we're very, very much influenced by our significant other.
And now, one of the things I love in your book, you offer all these solutions, and you talk about how your romantic relationships can actually change your attachment style so you can become more secure. And you talk about how to tap into a secure mindset. And one of the ways you talk about is be available, that you respond sensitively to their distress and you allow them to be dependent on you. And then another way is that you say, don't interfere, that you provide support for them behind the scenes. What does that entail?
Right. So basically, we're sort of walking into the secure domain, which we really, really like. We like, in the course of writing this book, Rachel, my co-author, and I really fell in love with the secures of this world. We like to call them the supermates of evolution, because they have this like amazing talent of being in a relationship. So one of the things that they do is what I told you. They have this happy wife, happy life philosophy. So they know that it's very, very important that their partner is happy too. But how does that work out? So one of the things that they, like, as you mentioned, they know that they have to be attentive to their partner and make sure that they're happy, basically. But some of it is also, it's not always like being super attentive. It takes really a lot of talent. Some of it is actually what we refer to is the principle of non-interference, that you shouldn't actually interfere too much if you don't have to. And that's also very important.
Well, it's being sensitive to their needs. So, for example, people who know me don't call me on Monday or Tuesday. And my boyfriend's very sweet about this because, you know, we talk on the phone all day other days. And on Monday and Tuesday, it's just, you know, it's my deadline day. And so it would be damaging, you know, if he called me a lot on that day or called me at all, because it gets me out of my focus. So that's the kind of thing where somebody knows when closeness, which you normally love, is a bad thing and hurts you. So they're behaving in a way that's loving by not contacting you.
Exactly. I think I love this example because, again, it's very, very it really depends on the situation. So, but the most important thing is your well-being. And so if that's going to bother you and throw you off, so maybe instead of calling you, they'll send you a little text. But also on your part, if you know that it really bothers him that you're not contacting him, you might send him a little text when you're taking a break, thinking about you, XO. So that's just like a small way of sort of maintaining, of really taking care of each other, you know. And the thing is, I think this whole thing of non-interference will go back. That's why I really love that strange situation test, because it's easier to see it in kids. So imagine for a moment.
Wait, remind people, we have new people who tune in, so just remind people what the strange situation test is.
So basically, it's a test that was done by Mary Ainsworth, where she actually saw how children would behave. Like, she put a child and the mother, a one-year-old with a mother in a room full of toys. The child started playing with everything, and the mother would leave the room, and they would start sort of crying and like really calling for the mother, which is basically protest behavior. and then the mother would come back, and then the reaction of the child to the mother, that would determine attachment styles. That's where attachment styles were first discovered. So if the child comes, hugs the mother and calms down right away, he's secure. If he has a hard time coming down and keeps on crying and crying and not wanting to play with the toys, then they're anxious. And they were just like staying limp in the mother's hands and sort of just checking out, that would mean that they're avoidant. But it's basically, imagine what would happen if the mother would basically stand on top of the child and tell him, play with this toy, but no, play with this toy, or play with it this way or that way. The child wouldn't want to play anymore. It would completely curb their exploratory drive. And it's the same thing as basically the example that you mentioned. If you are like standing on top of someone when they need their peace and quiet to create something, it's going to be very hard for them. Then they're not going to feel secure. So too much attention may also not be good at a certain point.
Yeah, I think that that's really important to note. You have to really be sensitive to start trying to read your partner, and it helps if you're not all tuned up where you don't have this constant fight about closeness. If the person who is the one who wants more closeness can sometimes just understand the person loves them, remind themselves of that, and if the distancer can give a little bit, make that phone call, send a text, you know, it's just these tiny things that make the difference. And one of the things you talk about, too, that's really horrible is stable instability, where a relationship lasts for a long time, but there's this element of uncertainty. It's really unfair to the person who is the anxiously attached person, the closeness-seeking person. There's chronic dissatisfaction, you know, and that person's never – they're always chasing the closeness they can't get, and I think that's really cruel.
So I think that's actually you're describing that what we like to call the anxious avoidant trap is like two people who really love each other a lot, but they really and they really do, but they have this really mismatch in their attachment style, and they can stay with each other for decades basically but really research shows that they're less satisfied in their relationship because there's always this tension between them, and basically their relationship is stably unstable. There's a lot of fights, a lot of drama, or just like this really unsatisfactory. They don't always feel safe in their relationship because they don't feel that there's the closeness that they crave, and it's a big problem. It's a problem for both. Because it's a dyad. It's something that happens in the space between two people, and then both parties don't have the secure base that they need.
And now one of the exciting things in your book, and I should do a little station ID, I'm talking with neuroscientist Dr. Amir Levine, co-author with Rachel S.F. Heller of Attached, The New Science of Adult Attachment and How It Can Help You Find and Keep Love. I highly recommend this book. It's so practical, and it's based in science. All the science is there, but written very clearly and simply. It's really, really a helpful book, which is why I have you on my show tonight. And I wanted to talk about how the couple, where it's the distancer and the person who wants greater closeness, how they can find some peace and security. And you talk about security priming, you know, that you're reminding the anxious person, reminding themselves of security enhancing experiences they've had, like a past relationship with a secure person and the behavior that went on and images and recollections, so they can become less fear-based in their behavior and their thinking.
Right, so the security priming, it turns out, is really, really helpful for everyone, but also for avoidance and for anxious. And that's one of the things that were so surprising in the research, is that even if they just showed people who are anxious or avoidant movies or stories of people who are in secure relationships, it would make them more secure. But if you really think about it, we all even have, within ourselves, we have secure role models. And even like the way, for example, I would like to give this example, I was like the way that we treat our pets, for example. We tend to be very forgiving to our pets, but sometimes they can be very destructive. They can really just make a lot of mess at home. But we tend to be very, very forgiving. And even if we just be one-tenth as forgiving towards our partners as we are towards our pets, that can sort of really give us a much more secure way of dealing with them.
I'm laughing because my dog peed on the floor today, so I put her in doggy jail, which is a bathtub, and I don't think that my boyfriend would really appreciate being put in there as a punishment.
Right, but it's more like as a way to kind of like teach her something, right? It's not like that you would be upset with her all day because of
that. Oh, no. It's just, it's, you know, she does, now she knows that, oh, this is a bad place. My little claws don't work well on that kind of floor, and I'm not going to do that again for a long time. So
right.
I think that's perhaps not right, but I see your point with the pets. You know, and one thing I wanted to say, you know, is this thing of, you know, that people who are insecurely attached, who are anxiously attached, where they're, those are the people chasing intimacy, that one thing they can do is behave as if they're secure. And, you know, I was kind of a suck up for a lot of my life because I grew up with no friends, and I realized this wasn't a really very good strategy. I was having people walk all over me. And so what I did was I looked at how non-suck ups behave. They stood up for themselves. They had opinions. And so even though I was terrified to do that, you know, it wasn't some emotionally internalized behavior, I just acted like a person who was more secure, and it helped me see that that behavior actually led to fruitful outcomes, and so it helped me then get to it psychologically. Maybe that would be helpful in this case also.
Yeah, so basically they're sort of acting as if, you know, that's really,
exactly.
Really cool. I think, yeah, I think so too. I think the other thing I think what's really, really good for people who are anxious is to what's really amazing about people who are secure is that they really know how to fight fair. And I think that's something that's very important for people who are anxious to know. And I mean, I can give you, like, I'll give you an example. For example, let's say that my in-laws are supposed to come to dinner and I'm cooking for them. But then I have this whole list, and I ask, like, I feel like, okay, I have to go. Like, basically ask my partner to go and get stuff from the grocery store. So there's this list, but then they come back, and all of a sudden I ask them for A, B, C. They brought X, Y, and Z. So if I get upset, I can say, you know, I can't believe this. I really want to go make a good impression on your parents, but you really are not helping me here. But if I'm secure, I'm just going to say, you know, you have to go back to the grocery store and get me all the list of the things that I need to. But if you're anxious, you will go into, you're no good. I can't believe you do this. You always do this to me. How dare you? Like, now I have to stay. I'm not cooking dinner for them. You cook yourself. And so you see, there's a very, very big difference between how people who are always people who are anxious fight and people who are secure fight.
People
who are secure really stay very focused on a very specific topic, and they don't go and generalize. And I think generalizing is very, very, very bad.
Yeah, you write about this. I think that that's very important. And you see, you know, the attack and blame, you know, it's me versus you, whereas the other one's just, oh, this is a bummer. You're going to have to fix this, where it doesn't have that, you know, that lit up quality of the argument of the person who's blaming.
Right. And it doesn't go into generalizations where you don't care, you always do this to me. All these things that the generalizations that they doesn't really give the other person any chance to redeem themselves. The absolute worst thing is the threatening to leave when you don't really mean to. And that's very damaging to a relationship. It's really scarring to a relationship. And I think a lot of people are anxious, like they really, because they avoidant, they shut down, and they try to get them to, they just need them to interact with them, so they go into something very extreme in order to get a reaction, and they threaten to leave. And that's very, very bad.
And so we're almost out of time, but I wanted to talk about how you say effective communication can help you both choose the right partner and express your needs and your expectations when you're in a relationship. And you talk about that this is this thing where you aren't doing that blaming, that you're just directly expressing what you need in a non-accusatory manner, that's the way that you can make things, that you can get what you want without turning it into some huge DEFCON 4 argument.
Right. So, for example, like for the example that I gave you with the dinner. So if you say, no, you know what, I'm really upset with you, you can say that, but because I'm really under a lot of pressure, you have to go back and get me what I need. What's going to happen is that probably the other person is going to go back to the supermarket and get you what you need. But if you go into this whole, you never, I hate you, I'm leaving, then either you're going to sit together and like in a horrible dinner, or it's even not going to happen. So it's much more effective to actually really stay focused, stay on target, and really express what your needs are instead of going into an all like a third world war.
Right.
People who are secure know that naturally. how to do it.
And what I hear you saying, that the difference is the situation sucks and you need to go correct it, rather than you suck and this is a plot and I hate you and I want to leave. You know, it really just takes it into some zone that's just, it's never productive.
Right, exactly. And it doesn't really address anything. And you know what? And then you're going to end up actually being more miserable later on. It's just really, really, and it's very damaging to a relationship. And we have to remember, again, because we don't really remember that the thing that people who are secure remember so easily and act, this is basically their basic principle in life, that the happy wife, happy life philosophy. It's just like you really have to keep that in mind. It's so important.
So explain what that is our final point, because we're out of time, but I want you just, because I think that's really, really important.
So basically, the people who are secure really have this innate understanding that their partner's happiness, their partner's well-being is their well-being, and not just as a metaphor, that this is a way for them to live their life. So that's why they feel, they know that it's their responsibility to keep their partners happy, that once you get attached to someone, you basically get the soul of the other person for safekeeping, and that you have a huge responsibility to make sure that they're happy and that they're being taken care of. And it goes both ways, you know? But once you sort of have that idea in mind, and once both people have that idea in mind, then you've already done half of the work, because then you're willing to compromise. It's not just like if you're compromising and your partner's happy, you know that at the end he's going to come back to you and you're going to be happy. And that really is such a big difference than if you think, no, each person has to take care of their own. And usually it doesn't work out very well, because you're so intertwined once you get attached. You have to take care of each other. There's just no other way.
Wow, I think that is the wisest operating principle of a relationship. And we are out of time, but I wanted to say I've been talking with Dr. Amir Levine, neuroscientist, co-author with Rachel S. F. Heller of this wonderful book, Attached, The New Science of Adult Attachment and How It Can Help You Find and Keep Love. It's been a great show. Thank you so much for being with us. I think it's really valuable stuff we put out today. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
When you don't go to Geico.com, car insurance can seem intense. Like,